Good morning. You are listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. Taken from the insert of the book that we are going to discuss today. Quote, for black women, the experience of being bound has taken many forms, from the bondage of slavery to the Reconstruction era criminalization of women, from the brutal constraints of Jim Crow to our own era's prison industrial complex. Dr. Damaris B. Hill explores black women, our struggles, our resistance and resilience in her book, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, The Incarceration of African-American Women from Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland. Dr. Damaris B. Hill is a writer and academic. Her books include The Fluid Boundaries of Suffrage and Jim Crow, Staking Claims in the Heartland, and Visible Textures, a Collection of Poems. Dr. Hill currently serves as an assistant professor of creative writing in African American and Africana Studies at the University of Kentucky. Good morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Kat Brooks. I'm so happy to join you this morning, and thank you for taking an opportunity to check in on the book.
I want to kick this off with you reading a piece from this amazing collection of poetry, and if you wouldn't mind reading a Sonia Sanchez piece.
So I love Sonia Sanchez because we, because of all she's contributed to my freedom and to the freedom of others. But we often think of Sonia Sanchez and we regulate her historically to one moment, right? Like the Black Arts Movement. But she has long been engaged in the struggle for freedom on many fronts. And so I kind of wanted to talk about that. And so I took this moment in this poem to talk about the way that her and other grandmothers got together to protest the war in Iraq and to specifically occupy recruitment centers so they would stop recruiting. So this granny is a gangster. Love wears a lanyard laced with readers. Love is a pair of bifocals, the rims of the nostrils nursing powdered lips. Love is a granny, a woman weaved from Alabama clay and concrete, one that can fold the names of your enemies in her tongue. A granny that sets out a candy dish full of sparkling laxatives for bullies. Sonia Sanchez has long been a soldier of love. She wields protests like wind. At 82, she marches like she is leading a second line, all at her knees. With her cane, she cracks blessings and calls your nearest kin. She speaks peace in a cadence of prayers. The army slithers down Broad Street, wanting weapons gilded from flesh. She shows the recruiter that freedom can't be paid for with my grandchildren's lives. Mm. Her love is strong. It is all knuckles and knotted. One, two, three, and four. Love doesn't want your bloody war.
When you said we're reading the poem, and actually when you did the intro, I was reminded about the documentary about her life that came out a few years ago that shows the grannies occupying the recruiter stations. Very, very powerful. What was your inspiration for writing this book?
Well, the inspiration, it was a long journey, as most things, but the inspiration for writing the book started with a type of natural curiosity. I don't always trust public histories or what the popular narrative is about a space.
Okay.
So because it's often limiting because of the way that history explores narratives and validates and affirms itself, oftentimes the hierarchies considering race, gender, class, sexuality, are embedded in these types of research. Mm-hmm. We know we live in a society with many publics and many non-publics, with multiple truths and then a dominant truth. And oftentimes, historical narratives focus on dominant truths. And dominant doesn't mean accurate. In fact, it's often a mythology that affirms some other notion of a popular American narrative that we're trying to uphold. So I was moving to Kansas, and this is often what I do with my curiosity. and my not so free time, because I do this even when I don't have time. But I read the popular narrative, but then I go directly to the archives, and I treat archives like they are a sandbox. It's one of my favorite things to do. I go through the archives and I look for what I call the glitch in the matrix. Mm-hmm. What doesn't affirm this narrative about the space that they have told me? And oftentimes that's where I find the most intellectual pleasure, and that becomes my play. And so that was true for when I moved to Kansas. I was reading all of these stories about how progressive Kansas is. Kansas was specifically designed to be the free state in the Union, and slavery was abolished there even from the inceptions of the state, which is different from other state narratives. And they often, the popular narrative there often brags about that, even though that's not true. There were slaves in Kansas, but they were as contraband, some were illegal. There were all types of notions of bondage. But one story of bondage that I found is that during the 1930s, in this prison for little girls in Kansas, many young women and girls were being medically exploited. And I couldn't really get that story out of my head. And so from there, I started looking more closely at incarceration and studying the statistics associated with incarceration. The 700% increase in the incarceration of women over the past decade, and the even larger increase, somewhere around 814% for Black women. And learning that poverty and addiction are the largest factors that influence this type of activity. And immediately, I started thinking about the experiences that I witnessed as crack cocaine and the addictions associated with it began to take over the United States in the 80s and early 90s. Mm. And I remembered all of the women that I looked up to as big sisters and as aunties, and how some of them fell victim to addictions or associated traumas with the rise in the epidemic and the crisis of crack cocaine that the United States popular narrative deemed as criminal, which also led to some of the increases in mass incarceration and the dismantling of many, many flourishing middle class Black communities and others.
Black women are indeed the fastest growing prison population. I hadn't heard that 814%. Black men are already locked up at astronomical numbers. How do you see this wave of the mass incarceration of Black female bodies as impacting the stability of the Black community and the Black family?
Well, first I want to start with children, because I am very concerned about the well-being of children. Over 2 million children in the United States have at least one incarcerated parent. And so when we think about the urgency for public education and the possibilities of a public education being a space of economic and social mobility for students, we can't address the intellectual concerns of a student if the health and well-being of the student is destabilized or the child is destabilized. And one of the ways it can be destabilized is if a parent is out of the home because a parent is incarcerated. Mm. So that may lead to housing instability. It definitely leads to economic instability and emotional and psychological instability that can have ripple effects. But another way I look at this is that as we promote the urgency to address the incarceration rates of Black men, we add to the invisibility of Black women within the social fabric and nationalist texture of the United States. And so what I mean by that is that Black women were the people that explicitly, for lack of a better term, did double duty in American history all of the time, but particularly in the early stages of the nation when chattel slavery was inhumane but legal. And I want to keep looking at these issues of criminality versus ethics and morals, because we have a huge disconnect right now between criminality and ethics and morals. That seems to be a theme in American history. Black women explicitly were doing double duty. One was the service and the labors of their hands, whether it was in some type of domestic service, agricultural service, or production service capacity. But the other was the production of children that in turn would be sold in the chattel slavery system. Mm-hmm. And actually, people that owned other people could actually gauge their wealth based on the potential of Black women that were in chattel slavery to produce other slaves. Mm. And so historically, we don't always acknowledge that fact. But we, as a collective culture, don't always unpack the impact of that double duty on the foundations of our democracy and the long range effects of this choice.
One of the pieces in the book is Sandy Speaks. I'm going to stay on this. Well, the whole interview is on this Black woman theme about Sandra Bland. And it talks about It Could Have Been You, which really resonated with me because I think collectively as a community, every time law enforcement steals one of our own, we feel it. And I think Black women doubly so because we feel it as mothers, terrified for our children and our, you know, our spouses. And we feel it as women when it's women. And so Sandra hit all of us very hard. How did it personally impact you?
Well, it personally impacted me because I saw Sandra Bland and I share some experiences of being HBCU students, experiences of reverse migration, where maybe our parents or our grandparents moved from the South to the North, and then yet in our lifetime we return to the South to be educated and more well-rounded. But also it impacted me because many people in my family are ministers within the AME church. And one of my family friends that is a minister spoke to me over the phone about how he remembers Sandra Bland actually visiting the church and coming to the church. And just as education is a fundamental paradigm of the Methodist religion, in the AME church, in kind is democracy. And so there's never a question about a person raised in this type of religious environment about what your civil rights are, what your civic rights are. You know. You also know to be an agent and a contributor in your community. And I think Sandra Bland's questioning of insignia was not a defensive posture of fear, but a genuine inquiry about what his role was and what her role was within that time and space. And she understood her role within that time and space. She understood that she was a free and contributing citizen. And she understood his role as being an employee of the citizens that was sent to protect and serve.
You are listening to Upfront. I am in deep conversation with Dr. Damaris B. Hill about a bunch of stuff, but really lifting up this new literary work, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, The Incarceration of African-American Women, from Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland. You dedicate the book, Dr. Hill, to your ancestors. For folks who may not understand what that means, can you explain? Because I feel like we, as Black folks, as African folks, are doing this more and more, honoring our ancestors. And I often stand in a room with folks that are not of African descent looking at us like, what are you talking about? So I wanted to take this opportunity to allow you to lay that out there.
Well, for me, that was taken out of, to be transparent, it's taken out of my prayer practice. Like, one thing that I try to pray before I read a text publicly or do something that's important is I want to thank God for my talent, and then I thank my ancestors for this time and this space, and then I try to do the work. And so when it came to making a dedication to the book, there were so many that I wanted to name, and the ancestors and, of course, the futures, you know, but I include them in the ancestors. And so because I opened the book with my grandmother And I end the book with praise songs for my son or tales about my son. I wanted to dedicate it to my ancestors, but then I also understand that my ancestors are not exclusively blood relatives, but they are people that have allowed me to inherit perspectives and possibilities based on their life, their learning, and their legacy. And so that's why the book is dedicated to my ancestors, because it's inclusive of those people that are not blood relatives, but have also given me an inheritance of authenticity, an inheritance of intellectual curiosity and gusto and affirmation, and have allowed me to be in this time and space as my authentic self, and have given me the ability to negotiate power. As smart as I am, I knew that I did not have all of the information about how to survive this time and place or how to negotiate power. But I knew there were other Black women that did, mm-hmm. that lived through even more terroristic times than we are living in. And I, you know, they became like my daily vitamins. Like every day, I would research another Black woman that survived this place called America and how she did it. I studied up because I decided not to die. So that was my only choice.
You brought up, you know, politics and mm-hmm. the shift at the White House. And we've got an election coming up in 2020. Mm-hmm. And we saw in the 2018 elections, really Black women doing the damn thing.
right. And, but that's also been true historically, particularly in LA and San Francisco, out there in California.
Yes, that's where I wanted you to go. Exactly.
That historically, we have always been the agents of change, the moral barometer, the ethical enforcers of this country. And nothing has changed. Just the visibility again has changed. More people have to affirm what they have noticed and not believe the mythology that the Black women that are acting as social change agents in their community are operating in essentialism and isolation. No, they are not. We are operating in solidarity, not only with other Black women, but within solidarity within the human race, even at the expense of you hating yourself.
Mm. Well, would you read Every Black Woman Knows the Constitution, Asada, in 1972?
All right. Every Black Woman Knows the Constitution, Asada, in 1972. You should have carried a shotgun just inside the arm, hemmed from pit to hip, bell-bottom pants and ballooned sleeves. If you followed Ida B. Wells' instructions, you wouldn't wear that hole in your shoulder. The one that can't stand being nursed or the grazing of a bra strap. The spirit of the grandmother is born through the body of the mother. You are a woman that chases fear, hugging it from the back. Happiness is not a reward with its salty hide of tolerance. You, African gypsy, two-stepping when presenting arms. Your joy is a belt spanning the Barrel House Blues.
Yes.
I like the imagery of that poem because I wanted to present, well, all of these poems attempt to present Asada Shakur in a more holistic, humanist type of way. But I don't only imagine her as a warrior woman or a militant woman, but also embracing the countercultural and revolutionary epistemologies and artistic creativity of the blues women.
Mm.
And knowing how to accept joy into her life and how to welcome joy into her life.
Mm.
But also the intellectual astuteness and candor of Ida B. Wells.
I just love that there's a whole section on her with all of these poems. I was like, ooh, I'm going to like Dr. Hill.
well, I mean, like, again, Her, like, there were also 15 poems to Harriet Tubman, yes, but I had to throw them all out because they located Harriet Tubman in a time and space, and it wasn't true to who Harriet Tubman was, because the real thing about Harriet Tubman is that she couldn't be located in a time or space, because if she could, they would have killed her and collected the reward of $40,000, which is equivalent to $1,100,000 and some change today. Mm. Ironically, the same price that they put on Assata Shakur's head. Mm.
You then go to a series of poems that are a little bit more personal and specifically dedicated to your son.
Yes.
Why?
So because I'm not going to give as many specifics as I can, because I work very hard to protect my son's personal identity. He's entitled to his own life and to live the way that he wants to live. And when he decides to disclose how intimately the shifts in the political climate impacted him, he will. He's going to write his own story. But you should know, I think it's important to say about my family is that I'm at least a third generation armed service member, right? Mm-hmm. On this side of my family, my mother's side of the family, who's from a different country, they're also involved in politics. So my son grew up in a religious culture that talked about the nationalist politics of the United States of America. Also grew up in a home where there were military decorations and military lives happening. And then even in his external family, he saw active political engagement in two different countries. And so with that said, my son has been interested in politics since he was very, very young. And prior to the 2015-16 presidential race, was very much so post-racial, because he's a product of a decade of hope and a decade of change. Mm-hmm. So he did not know this perversity of patriarchy and privilege existed. And it is a perversity and a public health crisis, as Milwaukee, Wisconsin has deemed it. So it really impacted his life. And psychologically, he began to escape through addiction. I suspect, or we talk about around the times of Michael Brown. Mm-hmm. And then it became progressively worse. He's in a much better space, but the need for escape for him was necessary. And I think for a lot of other Black youth that are so disappointed in the cultural climate and the opportunities that are presented to them in this America. And so I wanted to talk about the ripple effects and extended violences of the Black Lives Matter traumas and the mass media perpetuation of the killing of Black bodies, the mutilation and dehumanization of Black bodies. So once again, similar, I want to say this too, and this last thing I'm saying, but similar to how crack cocaine started eroding at the futures, in kind is this cultural climate. It's eroding at the futures.
Mm. I wanted to bring that up, not to put, you know, your family's business on blast, but but really to, we don't talk out loud. I mentioned it a little bit earlier. We don't talk often about the trauma that comes from just being Black in this country.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Just from being Black, we got PTSD. We have substance abuse issues. We have trauma. We have disintegrating, you know, relationships. We have all of these things. Just you could be college educated, you know, going to work, doing your thing. It, all you got to do is be Black in America and not be a hermit.
Exactly.
What do you hope comes from the writing, the reading, the sharing of this book?
Well, I hope criminal justice reform happens. Mm. One, on a larger level, on a personal level, I hope that each reader gets to enjoy the women in this book and hopefully start to strategize or begin to develop their own blueprint for living and living well in America, despite the perversity of this cultural climate. And I also want us to know that we're not alone, you know? Mm. And I want people to enjoy the poetry. I do want them to like the poetry. I mean, and I know that this book is seems to be like a cultural commentary, but it is also an artistic piece.
Mm. Well, I think you, mission accomplished, Dr. Hill.
Thank you so much. Beautiful book.
So thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You are listening to Upfront. I'm Kat Brooks. I have been in wonderful conversation with Dr. Damaris B. Hill about her book, A Bound Woman is a Dangerous Thing, The Incarceration of African-American Women from Harriet Tubman to Sandra Bland. Dr. Hill is a writer and academic. Her books include The Fluid Boundaries of Suffrage and Jim Crow, Staking Claims in the Heartland, and also Visible Textures, a collection of poems. Dr. Hill currently serves as an assistant professor of creative writing and African American and Africana studies at the University of Texas. Dr. Hill, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.